Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. With Vice President Dick Cheney casting the tie-breaking vote and one senator rushing back from knee surgery to vote, the U.S. Senate narrowly passed a deficit reduction bill that cuts federal health and student loan programs for the first time in nearly a decade. Republicans, such as New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg, praised the five-year deficit-cutting bill.
It is the one vote that we will have as a Congress to try to control the out-year debt of this country through restraining spending.
But Senate Democratic Leader Harry Reid accused the GOP of trying to advance, quote, an ideologically driven, extreme, radical budget. Also up for Senate votes today, controversial measures on drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and whether to renew provisions of the expiring USA Patriot Act. Well, joining us on the line once again from Washington is John Harwood. He's national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. John, what do you read into this morning's vote on this deficit bill?
You know, Republicans felt like they had to end the year getting this done. They've had a lot of blows that their party has suffered over the last couple of months, and there's been increasing amount of disunity in the party. And one thing Republicans have tried to agree on is some action to take to reinforce their reputation as the party of limited government, which has itself been under assault. And they finally were able, just barely, with Dick Cheney's help, to muster 51 votes to get this package passed. Still has to have an additional vote from the House. Democrats succeeded in altering it a bit, so it could get delayed into next year, but this is one thing that will allow Republicans to get out of town feeling decent about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Among the things that this measure would do, it would freeze home health care Medicare payments at current levels, make it harder for the elderly to qualify for federal nursing home benefits by turning their assets over to their kids, but essentially it cuts, what, 2.5% of the shortfalls here. How significant is it?
Well, you know, it's all a matter of perspective. The $40 billion cut over 5 years is less than half the amount of tax cuts that the Congress is on track to vote. And so that is, you know, by some measures, they're making the deficit worse. However, since they are the party of tax cuts, since they think tax cuts are important to the continued performance of the economy, they had to take some action to curb the deficit. This isn't going to solve the problem by a long shot. There's a lot more to do on entitlement programs, which are growing rapidly in the out years. But this is one step that they can point to say, yes, we are interested to some degree in fiscal responsibility.
As you said, the House has to vote on this as well before it can go to President Bush, but the House has already recessed pretty much for the holidays. So what's going to happen?
Well, the question is whether or not they'll be able to work out some arrangement with the leadership to, in effect, shortcut the process and have a limited number of people back. Sometimes Congress, by being creative with the rules, can get things done with the consent of both parties. But, of course, without the consent of Democrats, that's more difficult. It might have to wait until members can travel back after the holidays.
Mm-hmm. And oil drilling in the Arctic, is it attached to a Pentagon spending bill? Is this a reason why the measure is facing so much opposition here?
Well, that's why the removal of the Alaskan oil drilling is why that deficit reduction bill was able to pass. That initially, oil drilling was initially included there. There was resistance from Republican moderates, and now it's taken out. It's on the defense spending bill, and it could take that bill down as well. There's going to be a subsequent vote on a potential Democratic filibuster of the defense spending bill. Republicans will say to Democrats, how can you hold up funding for the troops? And Democrats will say, how can you mix up funding for the troops with this extraneous threat to the environment? And so there's a clash of those two positions, and the Senate's going to vote within a few hours.
All right. Well, John, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. There's another twist in the continuing controversy over the South Korean scientists who said they were the first to clone human stem cells. The Boston Globe reports that a photo claiming to show cloned human stem cells could be a fake. This is the latest in a series of questions about the research of South Korean scientist Wang Woo-suk. He's already admitted that there were ethical lapses in the way he conducted his research, and investigations are underway of all of his major research papers. Joining us on the line is Boston Globe reporter Gareth Cook, who wrote about the photos that are now in question. Welcome, Gareth.
Thank you.
These photos were in the 2004 paper on human embryonic stem cell cloning that was published in the journal Science, and this was really what shot scientist Wang Wu-suk into prominence, really. But you found out that these are not really the photos that they said they were to be.
Absolutely. So he's famous for two papers, one in 2004 in which he said he was able to do cloning of human cells for the first time, and another in 2005 where he said he was able to do it a lot better. There's been a lot of controversy about this second paper, and just last week he withdrew the paper. So we've looked at images from his first paper and found that two of the photos he included as evidence showing that he did this cloning are actually images that appeared in previous journal articles and which are not cloned cells.
So these photos were basically duplicates from other research.
They look like duplicates from other research, and it looks like he's saying to the world, "Look, I've cloned human cells for the first time, and here's a photo of it. And yet this photo is the exact same photo that appears in two other journals in which they're labeled as just normal stem cells."
It sounds like he basically just cloned a photo.
Exactly. I mean, that's what people have been saying, and I think that this just draws into question whether or not he has done anything. And the scientists I've been pointing this stuff out to and showing these articles to have just been amazed at how far this goes. And I think people are now wondering whether or not he's in fact done any cloning, and they're looking at his other papers, and we at the Globe are looking at his other papers too and finding more problems with his whole body of work.
Let's talk about those scientists for a minute, because you know the Globe published these pictures, and they basically, you know, obviously you're talking to an untrained person here, but they look like little blobs. I mean, how do you know what they are and what they're purported to be and all of those other things? How do you make that determination?
Exactly. So the photos are just one piece of evidence that's provided in these papers. So they provide the photos, but they also do a lot of tests on the cells, and they report the results of the test. The thing that's disturbing about this is that if they're providing photos that are duplicates, it just raises questions about all the other evidence, and at a minimum, they are very sloppy. And I think that, I mean, even the untrained eye can look at these things that we published, and, you know, it's available on the web, and say, look, these are exactly the same. I mean, we verified it by blowing them up and using Photoshop to make sure they're the same image, but you look at these and you can see that it's just the exact same picture.
And also verifying it with scientists who could look at them and make sure that they were exactly the same.
Exactly. Yes. So we showed these to scientists as well just to make sure we weren't misinterpreting something, and they examined these other papers as well, and they came to the same conclusion that we did, which is looks exactly the same.
Right. Now, what's been the response from the South Korean researchers?
Well, the South Korean researchers have not responded to this specific charge. In general, they've been saying that Wang, in any case, who is the head of this research, has said that he still stands by the research and that he will be able to prove that it's all true in the coming days. Some of his colleagues, however, have been questioning him. One in particular, Ro, one of his big colleagues, has said that he thinks a lot of this is fabricated. So we're starting to see the team split up in terms of whether they stand by this research or not.
Also, in your articles, you quote a Massachusetts company, Advanced Cell Technology, as being among those questioning this research from South Korea. But Advanced Cell Technology is a competitor.
Exactly. So Advanced Cell Technology, they are a competitor in the sense that they have also tried to clone human cells, and they are especially upset about this whole episode because when this first paper came out in 2004, their own effort was effectively shut down because they're a private company. The investors were no longer very interested in them trying to do cloning because apparently it had already been done in South Korea. So they obviously have an incentive to find these mistakes, and they're very angry and upset that their own effort was shut down for what now looks like very questionable research. But some of the evidence came to me through them, but obviously we verified it with other scientists, and also, just as I say, by looking in Photoshop, and it makes it pretty clear.
Gareth, could you remind us a little bit about this? This has been an ongoing story. This is just one part of it. There have been other claims of scientific fraud, and Wang admitted to ethical lapses as well.
Absolutely. So this is a story that's been dribbling out, and then I would say over the last few weeks has really exploded. And initially, the first questions that were raised about his work was concerned that he had used eggs from women in the laboratory. So in order to do this cloning work, you need access to human eggs. And the allegation was that women in his laboratory had actually donated their own eggs, which raises ethical questions because it's not clear that they can do that freely. So eventually, a few months ago, he finally admitted that despite denying it many times, he actually had used eggs from women in his laboratory and also had purchased eggs, which he'd also denied doing. So that sort of raised a red flag.
Mm-hmm. There are several investigations going on now as well.
There's a lot of overlapping investigations. First of all, Seoul National University, which is where Professor Wang did this work, is conducting a very aggressive investigation. They've effectively shut down the laboratory, installed a video monitor, taken the computers, and they're going to look at this all very carefully. At the same time, the University of Pittsburgh is looking into the role played by a researcher there, Jerry Shatton. Science, the journal where this is published, is conducting their own investigation of the 2005 paper, and then after the Boston Globe raised these issues, these questions about the 2004 paper, they said they're now going to look into the 2004 paper. And in addition, Nature, which is the sort of other top scientific journal, has said now that they're going to be investigating yet a third paper that this Wang group did in which they cloned a dog, or at least claimed that they cloned a dog.
How is it possible, when we talk about these photos, that someone else didn't notice that they were the same pictures and that they got published in these journals?
I know, it's remarkable, but what you have to understand is that what we found here is that the pictures they provided in Science also appeared in other journals, but these other journals were quite obscure. And so the only reason that I found these and other people are finding these problems is that because of all these questions have been raised, we've been combing the historical record. But there'd be no way to know just from the Science paper itself that this image was copied.
What do you think that this whole saga means for stem cell research?
Well, it means two things. One, there's sort of a political answer to the question, which is that obviously the sort of leading light of nuclear transfer, which is, what scientists refer to cloning as, it now looks like there are huge questions about his research and possibly all of it is a fraud. And I think that that's just a disturbing fact. And given all the ethical questions and debate about this, it may have some effect on the political debate. I think the bigger effect is on the science itself, which is that it now appears that the science is years behind where people thought it was. And so I think that a lot of scientists are just very depressed about this because it means that the work they want to do in trying to, say, cure juvenile diabetes or any of these other diseases they want to work on is now set back by years.
Gareth, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Gareth Cook is a reporter for the Boston Globe, and he's been investigating the South Korean stem cell research. Coming up, we ask if the research was faked, how did it get published in highly regarded scientific journals? Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about the increasing questions surrounding research done by the team of South Korean scientists who claim they were the first to clone human embryonic stem cells. We just spoke with Boston Globe reporter Gareth Cook. His stories indicate that some of the photos published in major scientific journals with the stem cell research were actually duplicates of cell photos that were published with other research. The scientific journals are investigating, but this raises several questions, such as how does something like this happen and how is the information in these scientific studies reviewed for accuracy? Well, to help us answer some of these questions, we're joined on the line by Marcel LaFollette. She's author of the book Stealing into Print, Fraud, Plagiarism, and Misconduct in Scientific Publishing. Ms. LaFollette, can you explain the review process and how fraud could happen?
The scientific community has constructed a system of review that involves skepticism, criticism, all the way through the line. And it begins in the laboratory. The next stage is in the institution itself, and then among the colleagues of the scientist in the discipline. The journal peer review, which relies on a system of voluntary criticism by peer reviewers, can only look at what is described in the manuscript itself. We have to trust what authors say. We can't tiptoe into their laboratories and stare over their shoulders to see if they actually did the work that they say they did. Mm. But there's no way that we can know that for sure.
Do you think that some of these journals are going to try to go and verify lab results now and take steps such as that to try to improve the process to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again?
Well, that has been something that has been consistently called for through the years, but scientists have perhaps understandably resisted that. No one wants to have that level of scrutiny, and frankly, to have to submit all of your data every time you submitted a manuscript to a journal would simply make an unburdenable, unreasonable, and unworkable system. It's been a system that's worked very well in the past on trust. Scientists are basically accurate and honest and conscientious, but occasionally someone is not.
Mm-hmm. In this particular case, we just heard from a reporter at the Boston Globe who said that photos were published in a 2004 paper that apparently were in a more obscure scientific journal. And this is basically photos, but they were the exact same photos claiming to be two different things. It seems almost astonishing that something like that could have gone unchecked. What do you make of that?
Well, it might seem astonishing, except that it's also astonishing when we look at the amount of scientific information and the number of scientific journals that are published in the world today. So to expect every person who is in a specialty field to be familiar with every possible article that has been published in every journal and to be intimately familiar with every illustration is expecting too much. This is why we rely on institutions to police their own employees and rely on a system of teaching integrity to mentor our students when they're in the laboratories.
For these journals, they are conducting investigations. Many of these journals are conducting their own investigations now into the whole process and talking about the process and what went wrong in this particular case. Is this? Can you explain how that investigation might be done, and is this unprecedented?
Well, this is going to be a problem because the journal can only investigate the level of its own review. That's the only power that they have. That's their responsibility to be sure that they did their work responsibly and conscientiously. But all they can do is check back with their referees to be sure that their referees did what they said they had done, which is to read the manuscript carefully. And to check through their own sort of system to be sure that they were reasonably skeptical, that they had consistent standards applied to manuscripts. There's a balance here, and as in all things in life. But I think this is probably going to cause a lot of editors to look one more time at their review system and to look at their own review systems with a lot more skepticism, because they have a right, they have a responsibility to the public.
Do you think the process needs to be revamped?
There is no such thing as a peer review process. There is only peer review processes. Each journal is independent, and each journal sets up its own process of review. Each laboratory will be independent and set up its own process of review. So there is no standard peer review system as such. There are many different systems and many different levels of review. When I was an editor of two different social science journals in my career, I always practiced double-blind review. My reviewers didn't know who the authors were, and the authors didn't know who the reviewers were. I felt that would be more fair and consistent, especially in trying to undo various types of bias. Other reviewers in the same field did not do that. And they were free to set up their systems however they wished.
Mm-hmm. But do you think that there should be standards, or how do you think that the system should change to make sure that something like this wouldn't happen again?
Well, I think this is certainly going to cause many editors to go back to, again, some discussions about how
the editors and the scientific journals can perhaps apply more consistently their own standards. But it is very difficult to say that there should be one standard, because you, as a member of the press, editors and journalists at newspapers, magazines, radio, television, you wouldn't want to have someone set up standards for your reporting. You police yourself. You have certain standards that you apply and say, well, this is good reporting and this is not. Mm-hmm. And science is the same.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Marcel LaFollette has been a peer review editor and is author of the book Stealing into Print: Fraud, Plagiarism, and Misconduct in Scientific Publishing. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Talks on Iran's nuclear program are resuming in Vienna today. There's not a lot of optimism surrounding these talks. European negotiators hoped they could deter Iran from enriching uranium by offering economic incentives. But Tehran has rejected all offers to date. And most recently, Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, has made several comments denouncing the West, which have increased his country's isolation and heightened concerns about its nuclear ambitions. The Iranian president has called for Israel to be wiped off the map, and he has said that the Holocaust is a myth. Also this week, he banned all Western music from Iran's airwaves. To better understand what's happening in Iran, we're joined by Scott Peterson. He's a Middle East correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor, who was in Iran recently. Hello, Scott.
How are you?
Okay. And Karim Sajapour, he's an analyst with the International Crisis Group. He's usually based in Tehran, and he is joining us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Karim.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm okay. Scott, you have a story in today's paper that talks about Iran's president and how he seems to be transporting the country back to the days around the 1979 revolution. Can you explain what's happening here?
What the story is focusing on is on this situation and the scene down in Damkaran, which is a holy mosque. It's south of Tehran, and many Shia, especially those who are especially ideological in their religious beliefs, feel that this is the closest place where they can speak to the Mahdi. This is the 12th imam. This is the important imam who is expected to come back. The Christian equivalent is basically the Messiah and the second coming of the Messiah. And the point of this, and why it's important for Iran and, in fact, for the rest of the world, is because this kind of second coming theology that the president ascribes to is very, very much affecting the way that he sees Iran, the way that he sees domestic politics and his role in those domestic politics in Iran, and also it's shaping the hard line that he is taking in nuclear negotiations as well as regarding the United States and Israel.
But explain that a little bit. That fundamentalist sort of view of things affects particularly the talks, the nuclear program talks, exactly how?
Well, in this sense, his view is that Iran needs to prepare itself for the return of the Mahdi, and it's something that he feels is fairly imminent. Some people say that he feels that this could happen literally as quickly as 2 years, 3 years, 4 years away, and basically he feels that Iran needs to prepare itself, and it needs to basically bring about a degree of justice in terms of balance, if you will, between the rich and poor in the country domestically, but more crucially, outside, it means that he feels that because the Mahdi will be returning soon and bringing a kind of more overall Islamic justice, it means that there's no reason to take any soft line or any compromising positions, especially with the United States and especially on the issue of nuclear power, which Iran determines that it needs for itself.
Hmm. Karim, I'm wondering, you're Iranian. You spend a lot of time in the country. What do people there say about his comments and what's happening?
Well, I think there's generally lots of concern about the direction in which Ahmadinejad is taking the country into. You know, he ran on a platform of improving the economy, of decreasing this gap between rich and poor, and he did a fairly good job of suppressing these very radical religious ideological tendencies that it's now very obvious that he has. So I think a lot of people are probably thinking, you know, this is not why we voted for you. We voted for you out of, you know, a hope that you were going to improve our economic situation. And I think very few people look fondly at the early days of the revolution when Iran was isolated politically, when the economy was not doing very well. So I think they're not going to be very patient with Mr. Ahmadinejad if, you know, 6 months from now, a year after he was inaugurated, the economy has not been improved. In fact, it's gotten worse due to his hardline political stance.
So is there discussion about that? And are there editorials and columns? Are people criticizing him? Or what's happening?
Yeah, in fact, you know, it's been very interesting that even the conservatives, his own party, has been very critical of some of his policies. What Scott was talking about, some of his messianic tendencies, you know, very religious, ideological tendencies. Even within his own party, people have said to him, you know, this is not to be taken literally. We should be planning for the long term in Iran. And from the reformist press as well, people have been very critical, editorials criticizing the president.
Let's go back to the talks in Vienna today for a moment. I'm wondering, Scott, can you tell me, aside from religious underpinnings, is there also something strategic going on here? Is Iran looking at, say, North Korea's example and trying to follow that to see if they can cut a deal to keep a domestic nuclear program?
Well, Iran very, very much feels that it is its right, according to the non-proliferation treaty, to enrich uranium inside Iran itself. It doesn't understand, or at least it says it doesn't understand, why it is being treated as a separate case, why there are all these conditions that are being placed on it when, according to its own reckoning, it has been very, very forthcoming and open with weapons inspectors, with the International Atomic Energy Agency, and really those IAEA inspectors have not found any smoking gun. So even diplomats, in fact, in Tehran are saying that really the nuclear file, as Iran describes it, could in fact be closed in terms of the big ticket issues. But the problem is really one of confidence, and that is that it's not just a question of the president's hardline recent statements that have made people concerned, but also simply that the levels of trust are not there in the West that would be permissive enough to allow Iran to actually enrich uranium on its own soil. So really what we're dealing with is a conundrum where there's very, very little middle ground.
Hmm. Kareem, I'm wondering, do Iranians think that the country's nuclear program is a source of national pride, or how do they view these talks and what's been happening?
Well, I think that there's not a monolithic Iranian opinion. There are plenty of Iranians who feel strongly about this, thinking it's a nationalistic issue, and why should Iran be treated differently than Brazil or South Africa or other nations which have tried to pursue a nuclear program. I think plenty of other Iranians are ambivalent. There's concern that, you know, the nuclear program in the hands of this particular regime could be dangerous, you know, given that, you know, maybe they have ambitions for a nuclear weapons program. And there's plenty of people who are simply uninformed. You know, this is a very complex technical issue, the act of enriching uranium on Iranian soil. And I think very few people could maybe wake up in the morning and say, you know, this is what our country is lacking, your indigenous uranium enrichment.
Do you think there's a willingness to get rid of the program, give it up?
Not to totally give it up, but I think that from the Iranian popular perspective, if there was a generous offer made in which, you know, Iran would make certain compromises on this issue in exchange for very generous political and economic incentives, you know, extending, you know, Iran a hand to re-enter the international community, to have positive diplomatic relations with the West, with the United States, with the European Union. I think plenty of Iranians, you know, especially given that two-thirds of the Iranian population is very young, under 30, I think this is what they long for. They long to be a part, again, of the international community, much more than they long for having a nuclear program.
Well, thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Scott Peterson is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Kareem Sajapour is an analyst for the International Crisis Group based in Tehran. Still to come, cookbooks for Christmas. Hear what's on our list. You're listening to Here and Now. Today's Washington Post is reporting that a judge has resigned from the special court that oversees government surveillance in protest of President Bush's authorization of a secret domestic spying program. Although U.S. District Judge James Robertson did not say why he's stepping down, the newspaper says he's concerned about the legality of the president's program and how that then may call into question some of his rulings. Joining us on the line from Washington is Daphna Linzer. She's national security reporter for The Washington Post, and she co-wrote the paper's lead story today. Daphna, tell us more about the court and Judge Robertson.
11 judges in Washington are members of a secret foreign intelligence surveillance court known as a FISA court. And these judges are appointed by the head of the Supreme Court. In fact, this judge in question was Judge James Robertson, who was appointed to the bench by President Clinton but selected for the FISA court by Chief Justice William Rehnquist when he was running the court. And Judge Robertson, we are told, has stepped down exactly as you described in protest over this new domestic spying program that President Bush secretly authorized shortly after September 11th.
But that wasn't the public explanation he gave for his resignation.
He gave, in fact, he gave no public explanation for why he resigned, but those close to him have said that it was definitely in protest over this program. And what we are learning about the program is coming out in bits and pieces. That what we don't yet have a full understanding of is how this may have impacted decisions that a judge like Judge Robertson or other judges on the FISA court may have made. In fact, what appears to be the case is that they possibly could have been issuing warrants based on information or evidence that they were not aware could possibly have been obtained illegally. As you said, you know, the legal questions are very unclear. President Bush says that nothing that he is doing in this program is illegal, but there are a lot of questions both from judges, from constitutional law experts, and in Congress about whether or not that's the case.
So the concern basically is that their rulings, they may have been duped into making their rulings based on information that was obtained illegally.
Exactly, and without their knowledge. That's
right.
Exactly right.
Right. Is he the only judge to have expressed his concerns, according to those close to him who you spoke with for this story? Are there the other judges, the other 10, I guess, judges, are they concerned as well?
We know of at least one other judge who expressed very strong concerns going back to 2004. Actually, it's the presiding judge, Colleen Kohler-Catelli, and we quoted today Judge George Katzen, who's another FISA judge, who said, you know, it's not clear to him yet exactly what exactly the program is about and what the possible ramifications are, and that he was eager to certainly learn more, as I'm sure his colleagues are.
And how are they going to learn more? Are they going to take any action to try to make that determination?
Now that the program has become public, a wide variety of people in Congress want full information. They want a much clearer understanding. I think the administration is trying to do that by presenting Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general, to discuss details with them. But a lot of it still remains unclear, as does the legal basis in which the administration is operating on.
So there will be congressional hearings, though, yes, on this soon?
There's been calls from both Republicans and Democrats yesterday and again today. They seem to be getting a little bit louder for joint inquiries, both in the Senate Intelligence Committee and the Judiciary and in the House. So I don't think that this is going away. It's certainly going to be on the agenda after the Christmas break. Mm.
What's been the reaction from the White House to Judge Robertson's resignation?
We haven't had much of a reaction that I can see. I think that they're busy trying to figure out again how to approach the court and explain elements of their policy and, again, the legal basis for it and the importance of the program, which the president himself has said is a vital tool in the war on al-Qaeda.
Daphna Linzer, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Stay Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. One of the hottest selling books this fall is the Silver Spoon Cookbook from Italy. The book is so popular that it's hard to find in some places. Also, Martha Stewart's Baking Handbook is seeing brisk sales, while her business book is falling far short of publishers' expectations. Food, it seems, sells books. But as you wade through the many food memoirs and cookbooks on the shelves, which to choose? We decided to ask for a list of recommendations from two of our favorite food people, Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, and Here and Now's foodie, Scott Haas. Welcome to you both.
Hello, Deb.
Hi there.
Silver Spoon, Basics of Italian Cooking, basically the joy of cooking, right, in Italian. Isn't that right, Kathy?
It's some recent phenomenon. It's apparently the Italian version of the joy of cooking. It's recently been translated in English, and according to some papers, you can't even get your hands on it.
Right. But it's really traditional fare that we're talking about. It's sort of traditional Italian cooking.
From what I've been hearing, it's in every Italian home. It's, as you were saying, the joy of cooking. It's organized as a dictionary. It's filled with recipes, but organized alphabetically, and it's what an Italian, not to be stereotypical about it, but Italian women are the ones who typically cook in the household. It's what an Italian housewife will turn to when she doesn't know. Her husband's come home with something from the market that she'll turn to this book and look it up and then cook from it.
Speaking of traditional cooking, you both listed among your favorite cookbooks of the year Elizabeth Ando's Washoku. That's recipes from the Japanese home kitchen.
This is just a splendid book. It's just gorgeous. Elizabeth Ando is an American who married a Japanese man and has lived in Japan for many, many years. And she's really considered one of the leading authorities on Japanese cooking and is probably the number one person that writes and teaches Americans about what happens with Japanese food. This whole concept of washuko, it's about the harmony of food. It's a whole culinary philosophy about the principles of color and taste and matching things and balance and harmony, which is not a concept that Americans really understand when you talk about food or anything else for that matter. Harmony is not one of our top buzzwords.
Well, what's marvelous about this book is that it goes way beyond the whole issue of sushi and sashimi, which are to Japanese food as pizza is to Italian gastronomy. It's, Japanese food typically in Japan. I've been there a few times in the last 2 years, and I actually took a course with Elizabeth. It's a heavily vegetarian cuisine. It's very balanced.
But you also have to mention that the recipes are mouthwatering. Everything from soy simmered kabocha squash with mince pickled radish to soba noodles with tempura in soup. Mm. It makes you want to cook. She's a great writer. She's very clear. She's very poetic. And if you get a few ingredients that you probably won't have on hand, I think you can handle it.
There's a real precision about this book. Elizabeth trained as a physician and never practiced medicine. And you feel like this is almost like a medical textbook, only the difference is that it's all about food. I mean, you can really use this book.
Mm. Kathy, one of your top choices of books was Smokestack Lightning.
Adventures
in the Heart of Barbecue Country.
This is a very different kind of book. It's called Smokestack Lightning, and it's by Lolis Eric Ellie, and it's got photographs by Frank Stewart. And it's more of an oral history than a traditional cookbook. These two guys, one grew up in New Orleans, one in Memphis, hit the road. It's almost like a Hunter Thompson odyssey.
Wow.
It's about sex. It's about drugs. It's about traveling. It's about barbecue as a metaphor for American culture. It's beautifully written. You'll get hungry. You'll want to get in your car. You'll want to forget about gas prices. There's lots of recipes, but the photography in here is all black and white. The whole thing is in black and white. It's like a cookbook that they don't make anymore. There's nothing glitzy. There's nothing glossy about it, but it's about a real food, and it's about a quest to find the best barbecue. I just kind of looked at it and I thought, nah, this will never make my top list. And an hour and a half later, I said, whoa, I got to get to work. I have to stop reading this. It really drew me in a lot.
And Scott, on the other end of things, your favorite book was about someone putting roots down. Yes?
Well, one of my favorite books, yeah. It's called It's About Time by Michael Schlatt, who's a Boston-based chef, a New Jersey emigre like myself, and came here some years ago and opened up three of the city's great restaurants, Via Mata, Great Bay, and Radius. And what's marvelous about this book is that it's about recipes that you can use every day. And one of my complaints about cookbooks by celebrities chefs or by celebrities is that they're just not practical. They're marketing tools. They're about a way for the chef to advertise what he or she is selling, either the restaurant or products. But this book is actually useful. And in terms of recipes that I've thought about during the year, he's got a great cheeseburger recipe in here, which is kind of neat given the fact that he's sort of a high-end chef.
A new twist on the cheeseburger.
Absolutely.
Do you have a drum to beat? Because I agree with Scott.
Yes?
And this is momentous. Yeah. This
what do you mean momentous?
Well, we usually disagree, Scott.
I have to disagree. We usually agree.
On the celebrity chef issue.
This is the year of the celebrity chef cookbook. If you go to a big chain bookstore and you take a look at the cookbook shelves, there she is, Rachel Ray. There's Mario Batali, on and on. Some of these are books that you can use. Some of them, as Scott points out, they're simply vehicles to push the TV show. I have looked at these books. I have tried to embrace them, and I'm afraid I cannot.
Both of you also have cookbooks that are written by restaurant chefs.
That is true.
Those are on your list. Kathy, you
chose... Yeah, I tried not to like this book, but I just loved it. This is called Sunday Suppers at Luke's by Suzanne Goyne. I believe that's how you pronounce her name. She is a chef in L.A. She is a very hot chef, but she seems to me to be someone who is devoted to principle. First of all, to look at it, every page, a good cookbook, you need to drool. You need to say, I want that. I'm starving. And that evoked that in me every second I turned a page. Every single recipe in here, I truly want to make. I mean, will I? I don't know. From braised short ribs with potato puree, Swiss chard and horseradish cream. It's divided seasonally, which is really nice. So there's a whole series of winter menus. So, cooking seasonally is something we need to pay more attention to anyway. And this is an LA chef who doesn't really live with seasons. And yet she grew up in Connecticut and she seems to intrinsically understand it.
And Scott, yours was Boulevard the Cookbook.
Yeah, Boulevard is almost routinely rated as San Francisco's best restaurant. And what's marvelous about it is that when you read this book or take a look at the recipes, you really feel like you're in San Francisco. It makes me think, as I'm talking about this, of Kathy's experience of the barbecue book. I mean, a lot of these cookbooks are journeys. I mean, for people like myself who are relatively voyeuristic and who don't cook from cookbooks every night, it's an opportunity to go someplace, whether it's the Japanese book or the barbecue book. It takes you out of your own place, and Boulevard really brings the essence of San Francisco into your home. It's easy, relatively easy recipes to use, a lot of San Francisco ingredients, and also the mellowness of that restaurant. It's a restaurant that a lot of places have gone on to imitate, so it's almost like listening to a jazz musician 40 years after Miles do some tunes that seem like a cliche, but in fact, the restaurant is not a cliche. Nancy Oakes was one of the first great chefs to embrace seasonality.
And she made a gorgeous book. The photography in Boulevard is also just stupendous.
It's a beautiful book.
More and more people are buying cookbooks the way they buy travel books. They're not going to necessarily go to China or India, but they want to look at it and they want to dream about it. And people are not cooking as much as they're buying books.
It's like the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue.
That's you're not going to wear that bikini?
No, but it's like, I know that.
Oh, no, that, I don't know where he's going with
this. It's just nice to look at the swimsuits. That's all.
All right, let's leave it at that.
Yeah,
that's
all.
Okay. Last year he was talking about food porn. Now he's onto the Sports Illustrated.
Let's be honest, but a lot of people look at these recipes, look at these pictures, and they say, these are beautiful plates of food.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to do this.
And as a cookbook author, I say go for it. Buy the books. But if you can also use them and they work, more power to them.
True.
All right, thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking food books and cookbooks with Here and Now foodie Scott Haas and Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst. They have their own books. Kathy Gunst is author of Stonewall Kitchen Harvest, and Scott Haas's book is Are We There Yet? Perfect Family Vacations and Other Fantasies. For a complete list of Kathy and Scott's picks, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Public Radio International.